Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Thursday, the Senate Commerce Committee convenes to discuss the impact of the 1996 Telecommunications Act on the radio industry. The hearing, to be followed by others on newspapers, TV stations, and cable operators, was sparked by the Federal Communications Commission's review of its regulations on media ownership, the most sweeping since many of the rules were instituted decades ago. The inquiry, which began last year, could result in the relaxation or even elimination of key rules limiting mega media conglomeration of the U.S. press and entertainment outlets. Media conglomerates say increased deregulation over the last decade plus has resulted in more media outlets, more programs, more options for consumers. But critics of consolidation warn that further deregulation will allow industry conglomerates to powerfully dominate the American media, squelching the diversity of ideas, news, and analysis that they say is central to American democracy. Tonight, On Point, the mega media juggernaut and the future of the American free press. Who do you trust to keep the U.S. press free and fearless? Does mega media mean better media? And can conglomerates nurture a thriving marketplace of ideas? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight is Michael Copps, one of five commissioners on the Federal Communications Commission and an outspoken critic of the push to clear the way for media consolidation. Good evening and welcome, Michael Copps.
Good evening, Tom.
Thank you so much for being with us. Michael Copps, you've been speaking out when many others have not. What is at stake here? Before we get into the details, what is at stake in the move to clear the way for more media consolidation now among newspapers, television stations, and cable operators?
What's at stake here is how this industry is going to look in the next generation and beyond. What's at stake are core values that we have always tried to support of localism, diversity, competition, maintaining the multiplicity of voices and choices that undergird our precious marketplace of ideas and the sustained American democracy. At stake is the kind of entertainment all of your listeners are going to be hearing and seeing for the next generation and beyond. Is that going to come bubbling up from the wellsprings of the genius of this broad country, or is it going to be coming out of advertising agencies in Madison Avenue?
Now, we can learn something from what happened in the radio industry. John McCain's committee is going to be looking at that in the U.S. Senate on Thursday. There have been a lot of changes since 1996 when the Telecommunications Act passed. Michael Copps, can you just give us a thumbnail of what happened in commercial radio when restraints on ownership were cleared there?
Well, the thumbnail sketch, what happened is that we have 34% fewer radio station owners in the United States of America today than we had in 1996. What happened is we have 10 companies controlling two-thirds of the audience and two-thirds of the revenue, and basically three companies controlling, 60% of the stations in the top 100 markets.
And in your assessment, Michael Copps, what has that meant for the quality, the character of radio in America?
Well, let me tell you, I don't have an answer to that question. And my involvement in this, this whole debate stems just from that. We are on the verge of perhaps drastically altering and reconfiguring our media landscape without knowing where we are going. We don't know precisely what the effects have been on localism and competition and diversity. We have some pretty good evidence in the figures I have just cited that there has been a lot of consolidation. Mm-hmm. We have some pretty good evidence that perhaps that is leading to the homogenization of the kind of entertainment that your listeners are hearing. We have some pretty good indication that maybe we're not having the extent of diversity in our local news and our local programming than we should. But we don't know for sure. And I, for one, am reluctant to vote on changes that are this transformative and this far-reaching and this important to American democracy without having answers to those questions. And every day we get new comments in, but every day the comments seem to suggest new questions that we haven't even teed up. But this is enormously important. I mean, this is huge. It's not just billions of dollars, but it is billions of dollars. But it also goes to the the warp and woof of our democratic system.
How we see the world, how we understand the world. Michael Copps, with respect, you must get around the country as I do. I don't think it's so terribly hard to hear the kind of homogenization that's on commercial American radio today.
I think that's a credible argument, that there's a lot of evidence that we've had that kind of homogenization of programming. There's some evidence that it's very difficult for rising local artists to get their music played or their arts listened to, just coming up through that local station when programming is more and more controlled from agencies and station corporate headquarters, hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles away.
So now
we need to find out for sure before we lock ourselves in. And the question I have asked is, suppose we vote, as Chairman Powell tells us we must vote in
Michael
spring
Powell.
On all of this, right, Chairman Michael Powell of the FCC. And suppose, for the sake of argument, that it turns out that we either eliminate these caps or greatly loosen them, and it turns out to be a mistake. Mm-hmm. My question then is, how do you put the genie back in the bottle?
Because then these media will be privately owned by large conglomerates,
right,
and private property
is
sacrosanct.
Right. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of companies are already making plans for the mergers that will follow this. So let's get it right before we cast that vote.
Let's look at those at the current rules that govern newspaper ownership, television station cables. As I understand it, currently a newspaper is restricted from owning a TV station in the same city in which it's published.
Yeah, these rules limit a single corporation from dominating a local TV market or from merging a community's TV stations and radio stations and newspapers into one voice, from two major networks, from controlling more than 35% of TV households in the nation. And there's a lot of detail attached to that. But the bottom line is, if you were to eliminate all of these rules, you would end up with the possibility of one company in a town owning the newspaper, the TV, the radio station, the cable system, and probably a good bit of control over the Internet, which was supposed to be all of our salvation. So the question to ask is, is that good for our country? Is that good for democracy? Is that good for the entertainment we hear? Is that good consumer policy?
Is that what's being proposed? The chairman of the FCC, Michael Powell, an appointee of President Bush, says the market is my religion. There's a powerful move here to deregulate, let the market take things its way. Is sweeping aside all these restraints what's on the table, or are people stepping away from that?
Well, first of all, let me say that my religion is the public interest, and that term appears 112 times in the communication statute that each of us commissioners is sworn to implement.
The public interest as opposed to the market without further
about
elaboration.
The market, right, or market fundamentalism or whatever you want to call it. Now, what's exactly on the table is probably a moving target. I won't know that until we get probably 2 weeks before we actually vote and the chairman releases an item for our consideration. But long before we get there, I want to build up the record and the evidence and hear from Americans all over this country about what's at stake here. And it's not a question of, do you eliminate everything, although they may propose to eliminate some of these rules, like newspaper broadcast, cross-ownership. I don't know exactly how they're going to go on that. But suppose they just say, well, this 35% cap that no network can reach more than 35% of
nationally.
TV households. What if you increase that by 10 or 15 or 20%? Might not the effects be pretty profound there? And we haven't even teed those questions up.
Michael Copps, you're the only Democrat on the Federal Communications Commission.
No, that's not right. We now have a second Democrat. As about 2 weeks ago,
his
nomination was held up for many, many months in the Senate. Jonathan Adelstein, he's now arrived there. We're delighted to have him.
Duly noted and glad to be updated. But you have said, as this conversation has gone along, that there's a kind of effort to eliminate these protections against media concentration in the dark of night. What do you mean by that?
Well, This is right now pretty much of an inside the Beltway issue. But it affects everybody all around the country. So I don't want to have a decision made just by people, corporations who know where the FCC is and their lawyers and their lobbyists or some of the groups that we normally hear from. Yes, we want to hear from all of them, but I want to go out into media markets all around this country and talk to people and say, all right, here we are. What's the reality of diversity and localism? How has it changed 2003 compared to 1996 compared to 1985. And I suspect when we do that, not only will we get anecdotal information, I think we'll get a lot of expert information. I think we'll hear from people who have facts and figures and perspectives. Mm-hmm. They probably don't even know the FCC exists, but yet we're making decisions that affect the nature of the media landscape that they and their children are going to live in.
But as I understand it, at this point, there's only one hearing scheduled in the entire process.
Well,
nationally.
That's right. We've been pushing, and we have finally one FCC hearing that we're going to have in Richmond. I am determined.
Richmond, Virginia.
In Richmond, Virginia. I am determined, though, that we're going to have some more FCC hearings, and while I don't have a lot of financial wherewithal in the office to support those, if I have to do them on a shoestring without adequate support, then I will do it on a shoestring. Now, I would also note that as we talk more and more about this, mm-hmm. and it comes to more and more people's attention, we have more and more people wanting to get involved in the debate. So a couple of weeks ago, the Columbia University School of Law had a forum on this. The Annenberg School at the University of South Carolina is going to have one. I think there'll be several others. So I'm going to attend as many of those as I can, too. But I don't think there's any substitute for having the commissioners go out on the road and ask the questions and build the record so they can make an intelligent decision when that time comes.
Michael Copps, how do the politics stack up on this right now? Is there congressional support? Does it matter for the kind of deregulation that the chairman...
Politics of this are it's increasingly important, and it's nonpartisan or bipartisan. Mm-hmm. All of the commissioners went to Capitol Hill week before last to testify before the Senate Commerce Committee mm-hmm. with Chairman John McCain and Ranking Member Senator Fritz Hollings. Mm-hmm. The hearing was supposed to be strictly on telecommunications. What are we going to do with the telephones and the Bell companies and the competitors mm-hmm. and all that? We weren't into that hearing 5 minutes, maybe three mm-hmm. minutes, and the senator started talking about media consolidation and how important this is to them. And Republicans and Democrats alike, many of those folks were saying, we've got to be awfully darn careful we don't get ourselves into a situation where we have three, four, or five companies that are controlling everything. And in point of fact, we have less than half a dozen companies controlling a whole lot of it right now.
Are the politicians afraid to stand up and say that, afraid that those media conglomerates may end up punishing them at election
time? I think Senator McCain is going to have a hearing on radio consolidation, as you noted at the outset. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that he will have some others. And I think as this issue gathers a little momentum, we'll be hearing from more and more people. This is not, I said it's not Republican or Democrat. Neither is it right or left. I've mm-hmm. talked to people across the gamut from the creative artistic community, the writers, the guilds, the directors, mm-hmm. all across the mainstream, the people on the other side who are very concerned about the kind of race to the bottom on indecency that we have in the airwaves, and they're increasingly asking, wait a minute, might not there be some connection here between the rising tide of indecency that where our children are being exposed to and the rising tide of industry consolidation? I don't know the answer to that for sure.
But it could be.
But I want to have the question teed up and have some intelligent analysis before I do vote.
Michael Copps, we have you for only one more minute. Give us your perspective on where you fear this is headed if media conglomeration races ahead.
Well, I fear if it races ahead and we don't have this dialogue that we could severely curtail diversity in our airways. I think we could harm democracy. I think we could limit the kind of entertainment that our people hear. But I think that if people really get involved in this issue and if the media does its part to tee it up, and I think all media should be doing what you're doing.
Is it
even
doing
those
that?
Who have a financial interest in the outcome, they
are
have
they
a public
doing
interest
it?
Responsibility to talk about this.
Is it
Some
happening?
Some of them are, many are not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And everybody needs to do that. Then I think you'll see this broad political support for saying let's find out where we're going before we decide any votes on this. And that's just critical to our democracy, I think.
How much time do we have, Michael Copps, for that to happen?
We have very little time because we're supposed to vote in spring. I'm going to go out and have these hearings, but I think people need to be letting the FCC and their representatives and
let them know
opinion
right now.
Makers, their local opinion makers, and everybody else know that this issue is important. You know, the people own the airwaves. None of these companies owns the airwaves.
They belong to the public.
They
Michael Copps.
To the people of the United States.
I know we have to let you go. thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for teeing up this debate. I enjoy being a part of it.
Michael Copps is a commissioner for the Federal Communications Commission. We're talking tonight about the triumph of mega media. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the triumph of mega media and the threat to America's free press and the marketplace of ideas. Who do you trust to keep the press free and fearless, corporate conglomerates or local owners? Have you felt the homogenization of your commercial radio world? Will the conglomerated free market nurture a dynamic, diverse marketplace of ideas in this American democracy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We just heard from, at the top of the hour, Michael Copps, one of the commissioners on the Federal Communications Commission, that will be deciding on this spring. We're joined now from Madison, Wisconsin, by John Nichols. He's a political writer for The Nation and co-author of Our Media, Not Theirs, The Democratic Struggle Against Corporate Media, released just last fall. Good evening and welcome, John Nichols.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. And joining us from Washington tonight is Brian Weimer. He's attorney for the law firm Skadden Arps, which is representing Fox, CBS, and NBC in media ownership proceedings with the FCC. Good evening and welcome, Brian Weimer. Brian Weimer, are you there? We'll make sure we've got that connection to Brian Weimer. Are you there, Brian Weimer?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. Thanks for joining us tonight. Brian Weimer, I want to turn to you first because you're in the thick of this, representing some of the very big media outlets we're talking about tonight, who Michael Copps has been quite critical of. And of course, you know the argument. There's a fear that if more media end up in the hands of fewer companies, we will see right across the board in TV stations, newspapers, cable operations, the same kind of consolidation and homogenization we've seen in commercial radio. Why should we not fear that?
Well, I think Commissioner Copps focused perhaps unfairly on broadcasters in particular. In the comments that we filed at the FCC, Fox, NBC, and Viacom illustrated the explosion of media choices that has occurred over the last 40, 50, 60 years in large and small communities both. And let me just give you an example. Mm-hmm. For example, Washington, D.C. versus Burlington, Vermont, Plattsburgh, New York.
Okay.
Since 1960, the number of television and radio outlets in Washington has nearly tripled. The number of neighborhood suburban newspapers has quadrupled, and the number of local magazines has gone from zero to 25.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, D.C. residents now have access to over 150 cable channels, including a 24-hour local cable news channel, mm-hmm. 300-plus DBS channels. None of these multi-channel video providers existed in 1960. The explosion of media choices, I know Commissioner Copps was talking about a lot of our rural listeners, the explosion of media options has been no less dramatic in small cities like Burlington, Plattsburgh, where today residents can turn to any of 45 TV and radio outlets as compared to just 17 in 1960. The same number of cable, DBS, and national magazine offerings as a Washington, D.C. resident enjoys today. Two metropolitan daily newspapers, four times as many neighborhood suburban newspapers as in
1960. You're saying what's the problem? We've got a gazillion options here, a gazillion outlets. John Nichols, what about it? Is this a great furor over nothing? Are Americans looking at such a plethora of media options that conglomeration consolidation is not a really serious threat?
Well, my friend just referenced Burlington, Vermont. And it happens that last April, Bob McChesney, who's the co-author of Our Media, Not Theirs, mm-hmm. with me, and I traveled to Burlington, where Congressman Bernie Sanders had invited us to appear at the first ever congressional town meeting on media and democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And close to 500 people showed up. And I've got to tell you, despite what our friend is saying tonight, the folks who showed up at that event were yelling about how angry they were.
And what were they angry about?
Choices. They were angry at the lack of choices. They were angry at the homogenization of broadcast media, at the increasing levels of commercial and non-civic values that seem to dominate all of our media, especially in broadcast, but also in print.
How can it be that they felt so few options? Don't they know how to use their remote control? Brian Weimer's laying out the numbers, and it looks like a very large number of options.
Well, I respect Brian's point, but I think that the citizens of the United States have a different standard, and one that I'm very proud of, one that harkens back to the founding of this country,
mm-hmm.
and that is that it wasn't about the choices that one media outlet offered you. The King of England offered the colonies some choices. the people who founded this country were very determined that we would have a diversity of ownership, that we would have many different people coming from many different perspectives producing our media. What we are facing at this point is a narrowing of ownership. And in fact, Brian's clients put in a statement in the current FCC discussions in which they suggested, quote, there's no longer any public interest need served by the commission's ownership rules. Effectively, they're arguing for getting rid of any limits.
This is Fox, CBS, and Viacom. Brian Weimer, is that what you're arguing?
We are arguing not that rules that are potentially applicable to media ownership should be jettisoned. What we're saying is that the FCC's media-specific ownership rules should be eliminated.
So that's essentially what you are saying. I'm sorry. You
know, in their place, what the commission and what the public should rely upon is the antitrust laws, when properly enforced, will prevent media consolidation in economic markets long before it becomes a threat to the marketplace of ideas.
Brian Weimer, you have very large clients with large ambitions and stockholders who want big returns. What's the kind of ideal media world they would like to see? How much of the cable universe would Fox ideally like to own? 50%, 70%? What would the world look like if media conglomerates have their way?
Well, I think we should perhaps note at the outset that Fox hasn't been around all that long. By relaxing,
but it's growing like gangbusters.
Well, but by relaxing some of the FCC's regulations a couple of decades ago, some of which are trying to be reinstituted now, Fox was able to get together the stations necessary to start a whole new network, which is now out there and providing more important local news and other things that Fox is very good at. And so we think that, the world should be untethered from the anachronistic media ownership regulations, which really bear no resemblance to the current media marketplace, which has a tremendous number of voices. And we haven't even talked about the Internet now and how that has transformed the ability of people both to get information and also to express their viewpoints.
Of course, we know even there, the top 20 sites are owned in large part by large companies. Brian Weimer, you're an attorney and you've got these clients, but you're also an American. You must experience what we all hear on commercial radio. You know what's happened to the numbers in commercial radio since a comparable reform took place there half a dozen years ago. Do you really want to see that kind of homogenization come on into television and newspapers and cable? As an American citizen.
No, I don't agree that there's been a homogenization, and I don't think we should
have. Are you kidding? What do you listen to on commercial radio? I mean, you know how it's produced now out of just a few central production sites, over 1,000 stations owned by just a couple of owners. I mean, you must hear that. You must get around.
Well, let's talk about some empirical evidence here. The FCC asked a number of people to do some independent ownership studies on media issues. One of them dealt with radio market structure and music diversity. Mm-hmm. And that study found that there's actually been an increase in diversity on playlists. And today, consumers have more choice for what they want to listen to. And I think that's a good thing. And we haven't talked about another new technology, digital audio radio service, which now provides 100 channels of audio to anybody nationwide.
John Nichols, how about a conglomeration means more diversity?
It absolutely does not. In fact, Brian is a very smart man, and I realize he has clients who pay him a great deal of money. But as an American citizen, his answer to your question should have been, no, of course it's a disaster. We have seen rapid conglomeration within the radio market, and if we blow out these other rules, we will see that the media companies that own our newspapers and televisions will move into a similar level of conglomeration. And when he talks about studies that look at some of these issues, I would invite him and I invite everyone else to look at the very good study put together by the Future of Music Coalition, which found, first off, they did survey research. They actually polled Americans, found that a majority of Americans are upset with the lack of choices, their sense of a narrowing of diversity, their sense of a narrowing of options, especially musically, and also found that there is easily quantifiable evidence that we have fewer choices on radio, that there is a formatting that has come in, that even when these media conglomerates suggest that there are different formats, for country and light country and things like that, that it is in fact the same music being recycled in all sorts of different ways. And worst of all, under this, the recent changes that have come through since the Telecommunications Act of 1996, we have seen the reintroduction of payola. As the Miami Herald series at the start of this year.
Payola, meaning pay to play.
Yes, exactly. And instead of giving the people what we want, we've got a situation now where so few individuals, so few companies control so much of our radio that it is very easy for corrupt players to buy their way in and to get music played, not because it's what the people want and not because it's diverse or interesting, but because they've got the bucks.
So let's fast forward. Brian Weimer, part of what is under discussion here and could soon be the norm is that newspapers and TV stations in a single town could be owned by the same company. Now, why would someone want that? What would the advantage be? You call these rules anachronistic, but why would I want the major newspaper and the major television station in my town or city owned by one owner, shaping my entire view of the world? Why would I want that?
Well, there are some benefits, many benefits.
What would they be for the consumer, for the citizen?
Well, let's talk about, for example, I know this is another one of our guests will be discussing local news issues. I know those are important to her. The networks are prohibited from expanding into additional markets by virtue of the FCC's national cap. But we have done extensive empirical studies to show and demonstrate that owned and operated stations by the networks actually do a better job of providing local news and information to people
in
their
be?
Local markets.
You mean,
why is that?
You mean something about scale? They're more efficient?
Right. They can enjoy the efficiencies of scale, as you say.
But I wonder if it's really in the interest of a democratic proceeding to put all that media power in a given community into the hands of one owner. I want to turn to the phones. A lot of people want to join this conversation. Chris is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing tonight?
Well, thanks.
I work at a small weekly paper north of Wisconsin here, and in the past 3 years it had been bought by a chain of a corporation that owns 37 daily papers throughout the country.
Okay.
It's been an interesting experience, 7 months I've been there.
Has it improved the coverage, Chris?
It's closed down the coverage. Fewer pages with less stories, less diverse stories, and it's been really interesting.
What do you mean by interesting?
To try and do the job that is required to inform a community about the issues going on there has gotten probably two times as hard simply because there's less staff, which means you have to make up for the shortcomings. And you really go home at night wondering if the community has been served with that week's paper, if all the issues that should be getting out are getting out.
Well, there's a report from the front lines. Chris, thanks for your call. John Nichols, here's a reporter working in your state, Wisconsin, saying consolidation has come to his newspaper and it's not working.
I hear this everywhere I go in America, and I probably give about 50 to 60 speeches a year on this topic. It used to be 5 or 6 years ago, and I've been a working journalist all my adult life, more than 20 years, but it used to be 5 or 6 years ago, if I went before a crowd and there was a journalist in the room, the journalist would stand up and say, you know, hey, we're still trying and we're still doing a good job. I never hear that anymore. In fact, I've got to tell you, the people who are screaming loudest about these proposed changes in regulations that are before the FCC right now are journalists. The Newspaper Guild is militantly opposed to it. The AFTRA, which represents a lot of broadcast personalities and workers, militantly opposed to it. The entertainment unions in Hollywood, militantly opposed.
Is that just because they're afraid for their jobs?
Well, of course they're afraid for their jobs, and right on. Because you know what? If you don't have people out there collecting the news, and if you don't have a lot of people collecting it from a lot of different perspectives, you end up with the situation where instead of having journalists collect news and report on it, you end up with quote-unquote content providers. And that's your efficiency of scale we're hearing talked about tonight. And efficiency of scale is to have one person gather the news for radio, television, and print, and to recycle the same story in all those different settings. It's not good from a journalistic standpoint, and it is certainly not good from a democratic standpoint.
It certainly doesn't sound like diversity. Bob's calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
For the last 3 years, I've had the privilege of producing concerts outdoors in public parks in Boston. And I can just tell you that it's this limiting of who can be on the radio is just destructive.
Why? What do you see, Bob?
Well,
What's not getting on?
Well, I think just a multitude of great art artists. There's no hope for them to get on the airwaves. It feels unfair to me for us to just keep recycling these small playlists. I mean, and it just, I don't know, it's just frustrating as could be because we're underliving. We're underexposing ourselves to the great art that's out there.
Ooh, Bob, we're underliving. There's a phrase. Thanks for your call. Ryan Weimer, I'm still trying to understand why and how you think consolidation will lead to more diversity. It seems as though it suggests innately the opposite.
Well, I think that, we can talk about the economies of scale is one issue.
But economies of scale don't necessarily produce diversity.
Let me just back up a second. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the commission has tried to address is whether there's a correlation between what it calls outlet diversity and viewpoint diversity.
Mm-hmm.
There have been arguments that there's a one-to-one correlation. Each outlet should equal a new a viewpoint.
You mean independently owned outlet or even?
Yes, would equal one new viewpoint.
Yes.
The commission in 1984 concluded that the empirical evidence based that it had in front of it did not support that conclusion anymore, that in fact media owners who have more than one ownership interest in a local outlet actually present many viewpoints. And not only that...
present many viewpoints.
Yes, present many viewpoints. Mm. And even within... today we have programming where different viewpoints are expressed in a single program. Kennedy and Holmes, for example, on Fox Cable presents a liberal and a conservative viewpoint on particular issues. So the scale is one issue, but in addition we have this ability of the questioning by the FCC of its own volition, the premise that a single owner speaks with a single monolithic viewpoint, and Congress has basically told the FCC that it must strike down the rules unless it can find some basis for the media ownership regulation, and if there is none, then the rules must go.
John Nichols, Brian Weimer describes the FCC, grasping in the dark and unable to find a reason for this deliberate promotion of diversity.
Well, there is a reason. It's called the public interest. And the public interest is well served by a diversity of ownership, not just a manufactured diversity within a particular network or a particular station. Brian references and misreferences, but it's actually Hannity and Combs, the Fox News show. And on that show, I can tell you that, yeah, they have a so-called liberal and a pretty genuine conservative. But I have never appeared before an audience anywhere in America where somebody has said, well, I'm really satisfied with the way that debate is set up, or I think that represents the whole of the debate. The fact of the matter is that this country is best served not by manufactured corporate ideas about from a Washington or New York studio about what a debate should be, but rather by localism, by at the grassroots multiple ownership, and that's what the FCC rules were intended to promote. That's what
make it organic, make it local. John Nichols, Brian Weimer, stand by. We're talking tonight about the triumph of mega media. Is the FCC surrendering control of the airways to big business? Do you trust mega media to shape your view of the world? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the triumph of mega media and the threat to America's free press and the marketplace of ideas. Do you trust the mega media to shape your view of the world? Do you want to drive across America and hear the same packaged music on every station? And will media giants stand up for dissent, for press freedom and corporate profits? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Brian Weimer. He's an attorney for the law firm Skadden Arps, which is representing Fox, CBS, and Viacom before the FCC. And John Nichols, a writer for The Nation and co-author of Our Media, Not Theirs. Right now, Neil's calling. Neil, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad you're taking this topic and talking about it tonight, because it seems to be being pushed through, and there really hasn't been a whole lot of dialogue about it. I'm a DJ here, and I got to say I've got 2 points on media consolidation.
Okay.
One is, it's very difficult to get a job in this business as it is, and what's happening is, as you have one owner maybe having 5 or 6 outlets in one city, it becomes really difficult if you actually want to, like, get your resume to another place, because one general manager can speak to the other general manager, or it might just be one general manager for all five stations.
Neil, it's hard to get a job in a lot of industries. Why should we care about a DJ? I mean, we love you, man, but why?
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, in general, it's making it more difficult for different people to break into the business, simply because, and it's also even harder once you're in the business to try to go from one place to another. And this isn't just for people that are on air. This is also for everybody else who's working in the station. I realize it's
But welcome to the world. That's the same in many American industries that have undergone, you know, more efficiency and more standardization. Is there a reason, and we're all for your career, Neil, but is there a reason that as citizens we should care about that fact?
I think it just simply is that we should care that there isn't simply one or two companies owning the majority of the radio stations or television stations in one city. I mean, I realize what I'm speaking about is somebody who's working in the business. But I think on a bigger scale, I don't want just one or two companies having everything. And the other issue is that once these companies do own these stations, they really try to squeeze out as much as they can from each one of the stations. I mean, the resources aren't available. And actually, like, just being able to bring more to the table is difficult because the stations are under a very tight cost-cutting control.
So maybe we don't want to see that same dynamic coming to television stations and newspapers. Neil, thanks for your call. Mike's calling from Spooner, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to go with quality over content with the lawyer's proposition. That's great that we got a diverse amount of radio stations. However, we only have one or two owners. We have cross advertising with different personalities, and it gets to be like you were, you know, complaining about homogenized. That's going to show up in the papers also. If it hasn't already, Gannett owns multiple number of papers across the United States, and I can just see the as bad as radio is now, it's going to be just as bad as in newspaper print. And what we're going to end up having is that 1984 Apple commercial where we're going to have one company basically dictating how we should see the world.
Well, I don't know about one, but it could be a few big ones. Mike, thank you for your call. Alan's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Good evening. I wanted to talk right to this, the points that the other callers have just had.
Mm-hmm.
In our area, the local Erie paper conglomerate has gone out and bought up all the local papers within two counties. I mean, it's a big chunk of northwestern Pennsylvania.
All right, how's it working?
Well, it would be fine if they would report the news and the facts, but everything's got a very heavy slant. As far as the conglomeration, so in the newspaper biz in our area, I'd be more than happy to see some other big chain come in and do some competition. That would be great. As far as our radio stations, what I find funny is we've seen some of the cross-advertising and different things like that, but it actually works. We've got two different sets of radio stations in town,
mm-hmm.
and you get – it's quite a bit canned, but I've got a choice.
So you feel choice there, but how would you feel if the local newspaper could also buy up the local television station? Would that be an improvement?
I wouldn't be surprised if – they already do own. I do know that two of the TV stations out of there's only four here, and one of them's PBS.
Right.
I'm sorry, five, and one of them's PBS. I do know that two out of the five are owned by one company or majority minority held.
Alan, we got it. Thanks for your call. John Nichols, where do you see this headed right now? Do you think the FCC is going to move in the spirit of Chairman Michael Powell, the market is my religion, to take these restraints right off? How close are we to that? How do the politics shape up?
Well, we're close, but I'm a great big optimist, so I'm going to suggest that small-d democracy might still win out. In fact, there's been a tremendous amount of ferment. The FCC has gotten over 2,000 filings on this, the overwhelming majority in opposition to changing the rules. And even Michael Powell, when he appeared before the Senate about a week and a half ago, found himself forced to admit that he was concerned about the growing consolidation in radio and to suggest some sharing of the concerns expressed by Republican and Democratic senators. So I think it's very possible that some of these changes will be beaten back. The problem is that in the United States at this point, media is not the kind of issue that it should be. It is an issue for the major conglomerates, and the big corporations are in there with their lobbyists every day beating a way to shape the rules and the policies in their favor. Luckily, most Americans are not in that debate. That's why this show is so good, and that's why the calls are so wonderful, because they drive home this point.
Do you think that media are actively avoiding this issue? Because, of course, many media outlets are already owned by very large
companies. There's no question that they actively avoid this issue. During the 1996 telecommunications debate, which was a huge restructuring of how all of our media worked, there was precisely one report, and it was a very short one, on a national network newscast during the entire debate.
Brian Weimer, I want to turn to you. Do you think John Nichols is dreaming here? Is he out of step with where the country's actually going? Has Michael Powell got his finger on the pulse that it's going to be markets, it's going to be less regulation, it's going to be more openness to large ownership?
I think Michael Powell has basically said, I mean, very recently, that there will be some rules in place, or at least a rule in place, dealing with media ownership regulation. Now, what that rule or rules are going to be, nobody knows yet. And I think that the charge that the FCC has is to take a look at the modern media marketplace, look at the facts, look at the empirical studies, and figure out whether its rules have any relationship to those policy concerns that we discussed earlier, localism, mm-hmm. diversity, and competition. And we don't know the answer yet. And we, the networks, that is, have given some studies, some economic studies, to try to support what we think the current state of the marketplace is. Other people have done the same thing. The FCC's own media ownership working group has done the same thing. The commission has to look at these studies, and if it does not base its decisions on the current state of the marketplace, it will be overturned in court, and that's the reason that we have this very proceeding in the first place.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's the debate, and there are the stakes. Brian Weimer, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us tonight. Brian Weimer is an attorney with the law firm Skadden Arps, representing Fox, CBS, and Viacom before the FCC. And John Nichols in Madison, Wisconsin, thank you for being with us tonight.
Great pleasure.
John Nichols is a political writer for The Nation and co-author of Our Media, Not Theirs, The Democratic Struggle Against Corporate Media. For information on how to voice your opinion to the FCC, go to our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, a Nigerian novelist writes of tough times in his country. This is On Point. Nigerian novelist Hilan Habila says the 1990s were a terrible time to be alive in his country. Under the dictatorial rule of Sani Abacha, labor unions were banned, newspapers and magazines were shut down, and journalists and activists were imprisoned and killed. Habila's first novel, Waiting for an Angel, is an extension of a short story he wrote called Love Poems, which won the 2001 Kane Prize for African Writing. It follows a group of young friends growing up in Abacha-ruled Nigeria. We asked Hilan Habila to tell us the story behind the novel.
This is the first book, and in most cases when you find first books, there's a tendency for it to be very, very autobiographical. It is much easier for a writer to write from a sure reference point. And I could say that for myself here in this book. Lumba in this book is a journalist. I was a journalist when I wrote this book. He was a young person who was coming of age in the 90s, finishing school and all that. That same thing happened to me. And I also had friends who were arrested in the 90s, journalists, young people who were trying to be writers through the military regime of Sani Abacha. I also interviewed other people who were in prison. So I kind of pieced all these things together, plus my own internal experience, my mental experience, because this book is about prison. And if you grew up in Nigeria in the 90s, you were living in a kind of prison, psychological prison, not physical prison. So I had that experience of being deprived and denied so many things that I could have had if that regime was not in place. So I just kind of transferred that into the story. The situation of young writers in Nigeria now is not very easy, but I think things are a bit different now from how they were in the 90s during the military dictatorship, when there was total sanction on Nigeria. A lot of people couldn't travel outside because Nigerian passport was seen as a kind of bad thing to the immigration officers and all that. But there's that easing now of the restrictions on young people. And because of that, you find a lot of intercourse between Nigerian writers and foreign writers. Nigerians could actually travel, attend conferences, and sort of things like that. So hopefully you find a kind of return of the situation that existed in the 70s. I think anybody who reads this book will be impressed by the fact that even though things were hard, even though there was that dictatorship, people's spirit was not killed. The people survived somehow, and that's one great thing about the Nigerian people. Despite all the hardship, economic, political, all that, the people continue to have this sense of humor. They have great resiliency, and they're very, very industrious. Despite the hard times, they keep surviving, and I think that's one great thing about the Nigerian character, and that's one picture that you're going to get from this book when you read it. Yeah. I'm now going to read from the last chapter of the book. It is titled James. Here in this section, we find Lumba and his editor, James, and a visitor, Joshua. Joshua is about to lead a demonstration at the local government secretariat, and he has come to ask for a journalist to go and cover it. James here is asking Lumba to go and cover it. Lumba doesn't really believe in politics. He works on the arts desk. So here we find the argument between them. Lumba waits till the young man leaves, then says, "I'm waiting, sir. Convince me." The laughter suddenly leaves James's face and he sighs. He shakes his head and stands up. He comes round and rests his arm on Lumba's shoulder. He says softly, "Tell me, have you finished your novel yet?" Lumba shakes his head, wondering at the shift of subject. He has been working on the novel for over 3 years now, but somehow a satisfactory denouement has eluded him. "But let us assume you have finished it. Let us assume it is a good book, potentially great. Let us say you have found a publisher to publish it. We are talking theory now, because in reality you won't find a publisher for it, not in this country." Lumba stares woodenly ahead at James's empty seat. James goes on relentlessly, whispering his words into Lumba's ear. "You won't find a publisher in this country because it would be economically unwise for any publisher to waste his scarce paper to publish a novel, which nobody would buy. Because the people are too poor, too illiterate, and too busy trying to stay out of the way of the police and the army to read. And of course you know why paper is scarce and expensive, because of the economic sanctions placed on our country. But forget all that. Say you found an indulgent publisher to publish your book, someone who believes in this great book as much as you do. And because you are sure your book is good, you would want to enter it for a competition. And what is the most obvious competition for someone from a Commonwealth country? Of course, the Commonwealth Literary Prize. But you can't do that." "And why not?" Lumba asks. He stands up and moves to the window, away from James, so that they stare at each other, the table between them, like antagonists. "Because Nigeria was thrown out of the Commonwealth of Nations early this morning. It was on BBC." They return to their seats. Lumba avoids James's eyes as he passes him. "You can't write with chains on your hands." James' voice is soft now, apologetic. "Sorry, I had to be brutal, but you needed it. We are all in this together. That young man..." I saw the doubt and uncertainty and fear in his eyes. "Of course he knows that in our country there cannot be a peaceful demonstration. The troops will always come. There will be gunshots and perhaps death. He knows that, I'm sure, but he is still willing to do it. The time has come when a few bruises, even deaths, don't matter anymore. That's why I think you should go, to encourage him and show him he's not alone." Lumba suddenly feels ashamed. Ashamed that he has shown himself to be insensitive, even morally wanting. He nods. "I understand. I'm sorry." James is his mentor, the one person he would choose if he were to choose a role model. He would want one day to be able to say exactly what he means, to mean exactly what he says, to shed all that is excess, unnecessary, so that at first sight his beholder could say, "This person is like this and not like that." James is about 50.
Nigerian writer Hilan Habila reading from his first novel, Waiting for an Angel, which comes out in the United States this month. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian.